Syria is in the news daily. There's a civil war on there, now 6 years old and grinding onward. We get a chance to understand the war and the people anew in a new documentary film called Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. It's already been screened in a few places and comes to the National Geographic Channel on Sunday, June 11th. It is not an easy film to watch, and that's really the point. People are trying to live lives with some semblance of normality in the middle of a war. Hell on Earth is co-directed by Sebastian Younger and Nick Quested, a longtime filmmaker who was our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Give us a sense, please, of where you and Sebastian Younger came from with this.
Well, Sebastian and I worked together over four films, starting with Restrepo, and we were constantly perplexed by seeing the war unfold on the nightly news, and we wanted to provide a coherent narrative to explain how the war turned from a series of civil protests into a civil war and soon became a sectarian jihad that led to the rise of Islamic State.
So I was going to ask you about your thoughts on the coverage of what has happened in Syria from the daily media. If you thought highly of it, you probably wouldn't have done this documentary.
I mean, I think the coverage is, you know, in some ways is exceptional. But it, when you see things in, you know, in bite-sized pieces, it's very hard to understand what the meal's going to be. So we wanted to put everything in context and juxtapose, certain things against each other, to create a more coherent narrative.
Do you think, Nick, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what has happened in Syria by the rest of the world?
I think that, as people have seen, I think some people choose to deliberately misunderstand. Our film is trying to sensitize people to the fact that, this is one of the greatest tragedies of our generation, potentially the greatest tragedy, and the enormous displacement of people is another, catastrophe on epic scale. And I don't think people really appreciate how many people have been moved by this and the choices that people on the ground are facing.
How much would you say your view of what's going on there has changed just through the research necessary to assemble the film and the shooting of it?
Oh, it changed enormously. I mean, to be a consumer of news and then to actually spend, when we took close to 40 trips to the region and to Europe to try and explain, to capture all the footage. And, when you're actually talking to people on the ground yourself, you just get a much deeper and richer understanding of exactly what's going on.
So to go back to the beginning, which you do, and it really helps us understand a lot better, there is a direct link to what was going on in the Middle East and the Arab Spring at that time, isn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can look at the Arab Spring having moved across Maghreb, and the Arab Spring was a response to the corruption of the various dictators in each of these countries, and this is very much linked to the protests in Deraa. I mean, the youth of Syria saw these protests as their chance to fight for some basic civil rights and some human rights that were being denied them by the cabal of families that of the deep state behind the Syrian Arab Republic.
Do you think that there were potentially some smart moves that could have been taken by Assad that might have prevented civil war?
I think that if he'd had responded with less force at the beginning and put in some genuine change, that he might have prevented civil war. But that's not, when you have a paranoid government that feel that they're the next on the list of being deposed, and they saw Mubarak being jailed, they saw Gaddafi assassinated, they saw Ben Ali living in Paris. They decided that they would inflame the situation further to preserve their grip on power.
And inflame it they did. And we have a clip from Hell on Earth that I want to play here to give people a little texture for the Assad view of things.
The regime wanted a war. This sounds strange. Why on earth would any regime or government or state provoke a war against itself? the regime knew very well that it couldn't survive a genuine reform process. If there was a real reform process, one thing would lead to another. There would be more and more transparency, more and more crimes would be exposed. And in the end, at best, the president and his top officers would have ended up in prison, stripped of their stolen wealth.
A clip from Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. Co-director Nick Quested is with us on the Jefferson Exchange. So it gets back to the old standard textbook, it seems like, on dictators. They can be dictators, and that's about it. They couldn't be democratically elected people without ending up in jail at some point.
I mean, if you look at African presidents in the last 30 years, how many presidents have successfully ceded power and continue to live in their country?
A very short list, I would think.
Very short.
Yeah.
There's actually a prize of $10 million, and I don't think anyone's claimed it.
Oh, for an African dictator who can manage to remain in his own country?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. The movie begins with the people who are writing graffiti in opposition to the regime around the time of the Arab Spring. So I'm surprised they're still alive and that you found them.
It was quite... we had some wonderful fixers. Mahmoud al-Bashar was instrumental in connecting us to so many people from the throughout Syria. The kids, the... joined the FSA, so that's how we got access to them. But they, as you see in the film, they were a dozen children were taken and they were tortured and two were killed.
Wow. FSA being the Free Syrian Army, a lot of players to get used to here as we talked to Nick Quested about the film that he and Sebastian Younger co-directed called Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. Comes to the National Geographic Channel on Sunday, June 11th. We'll have a longer discussion about this in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join in by phone or by email, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Quested and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Syria today through the lens of a camera that put together a film called Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS, newly out from Nick Quested and Sebastian Younger. It'll actually air on the National Geographic Channel starting on Sunday, June 11th. And Nick Quested is visiting with us to talk about the process of shooting and all the many, many, many side issues in addition to just knowing that there's a civil war in Syria that we learn from watching the film. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. We welcome your input, your observations, your questions at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So how many times did you mention going to Syria to work on this film?
Well, we didn't actually go to Syria, but we took about 40 trips to the region through me and various other colleagues. And then what we did was we built a network of activists and journalists in who worked out of Turkey in northern Syria because it was too dangerous for us to travel to northern Syria. These activists, some people choose to fight with a rifle. Some people choose to continue to bake bread. Some people choose to work as the ambulance driver or a white helmet. But our network chose to fight with a camera as their weapon. And they would go out and we would discuss the footage that we were trying to get or the access that we'd procured and we needed someone to cover. And they would go and do it.
As I looked at the screener provided, and thank you for that, by the way, it seems like there's a mixture of material that's fairly high-quality stuff that was shot with modern equipment. And some of it looks like it's definitely from phones, but this is a lot of the street-fighting stuff where explosions are going up very close to the camera. So was, in fact, some of this from phones?
Well, early on, because we document the rise of the Free Syrian Army and the civil protests, and that is predominantly cell phone footage, and you can see the evolution of technology throughout the war. I mean, this civil war basically started in March 2011. So you can imagine how different the technology is between March 2011 and what we are now at 6 years. So think of what your iPhone looked like in 2011.
Oh, that is a big difference, sure. Yeah.
You probably still had a Nokia back then.
Probably. So, what were the people doing to provide for their own safety while they were obtaining footage for you to use here?
Well, they knew the environment better than we did at that point. So we provided as much support as we possibly could, but they were generally the guest of someone, and that emir or that sheikh would be the person that provided them safe passage. And
it really is almost like a warlord situation then, from the sounds of it, where you really have to have the permission of the whoever the big guy is, the Don, maybe you could say.
No, absolutely. It broke down to a series of neighborhood militias, and people hold territory and they have front lines, and it is absolutely, in many ways like a feudal organization. It's a very flat management structure there.
There's a very deft touch with the historical aspects of things. I mean, it helps to know that Bashar al-Assad succeeded his father, Hafez al-Assad, as president. And to get enough history there to understand that Assad the senior put down previous uprisings, but nothing on this scale, I would think.
No, it was a much more vigorous and brief suppression of the first rebellion. I mean, it's a rebellion, and then the town of Homs was obliterated and then rebuilt. So. But it set a precedent for their actions in this incident. They won that last war, and they thought they could do it again.
We have a clip here to play from somebody who spent some time in jail for protesting. I don't want to play that now.
In that jail, I witnessed at least the death of 80 people who died just because of the conditions. There was no oxygen. There was no medicine. There was no space for you. You can't sleep. There is no sleep. Wardens did not have to beat us. We used to do it to each other. You know, just like a couple of rats put in a small, small, small space, and we were just biting each other. It is a factory of terrorism. You would go inside as an ordinary person and leave as a terrorist.
One of the many parts that really make you think in Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS, co-directed by Sebastian Younger and our guest Nick Quested. That's one of those things that really makes you stop and think that whatever societal balance existed before this war broke out has been not only torn asunder, but there's very little memory of it now, it seems like, Nick.
Oh, no. I mean, the country is completely polarized. I don't think you'll be able to see, a successful, integration on a mass level. I think you're going to see a partition of the country and hopefully some type of peacekeeping effort to stop people, killing each other on a daily basis. If you can get people to stop doing that, then you get a chance for a little respite. Maybe you can create some safe zones, and maybe you can work towards some type of, federally partitioned country. You know, in the same way that the Balkans were partitioned, and there was, large movement of different ethnicities, but, that's been relatively successful.
All right, where Bosnia and Herzegovina got the Republika Srpska within it for the Serbian population, yeah. There are a number of clips that we would have loved to have shared with the audience, but couldn't because the speakers are Arabic and subtitles don't do that well on radio. But I want to describe some of the comments from Marwan. We meet Marwan and his brother Radwan, and what I really got from Marwan was he sounds like one of these people who had sort of a mild interest and knowledge of the people in charge of things, but as long as his life was in good order, he didn't much care. So this is somebody who's not easily moved politically, I guess my point is. But once his country began trying to kill him, he became very anti-Assad.
Well, actually, his brother was a little bit more politicized, and Radwan ran for political office and was then subsequently arrested, which is, one of the reasons that they, apart from the bombing from the Assad side, was one of the reasons that they left Aleppo to travel to Manbij. And we met the family through Adnan Al-Mohammed, the archaeologist from the National Museum in Damascus, who we were working together on the antiquity side of the story, where we were trying to explain how the Islamic State had systematically taxed and regulated the mining of antiquities and the value chain all the way through. So they charge people to dig in the ground, they charge people extra if they use mechanical machines, then they give them 90 days to sell the piece, and they charge them a 30% sales tax on it. So we were following this, and we actually went to a smuggler in the southern city in Turkey that was trying to sell a mosaic. And then while we were there, he mentioned that his family were in Manbij, which was ISIS-occupied territory, and that they were thinking of leaving, and would you be interested in them filming? And we were like, that is great. So we managed to get them a camera, and then they filmed themselves while they were in Manbij, and their journey across three or four front lines and then across the border into Turkey. We just gave them a two-page document of like, and then translated into Arabic about how you shoot something. We would tell them to concentrate on your children, try and give us like road markers so we know where you are, don't shoot where anytime you think you're going to be in jeopardy, and then tell us how you feel. And they just did an exceptional job of conveying the, you know, the dismal nature of living in the Islamic State. The reason that they had to leave, yeah.
I spent my time looking at these very moving accounts of what daily life is like. I mean, they're eating this very meager looking meal, and the comment to the camera as well. Here it is: breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But they had no fear. They didn't hide their faces or anything. And were they already out by the time this material was delivered to you?
Yeah, I mean, I met them in the southern city of Osmaniye, and that's when they first gave me the footage.
Nick Quested is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-director with Sebastian Younger of the new documentary Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS, coming to the National Geographic Channel Sunday, June 11th. It's been screened in a couple of cities already. You can join the conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange about Syria and the Middle East and any American involvement there and what any potential solution might be, American or not. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to what you were talking about with IS, the Islamic State taxing the mining of antiquities. This is a really curious thing that they would get involved in a value chain to get something of worth out of antiquities, when it seems like most of what you hear about the Islamic State is that they want to destroy antiquities.
Oh, no, they destroy the antiquities that they can't sell.
Ah.
And you've got to look at the Islamic State as, you know, fundamentally as a transnational criminal organization, the way a mafia is. And war is an expensive business, so they needed to finance that war, and they financed that war by taxing the people that live there. They tax them for their, if you pick the olives off the trees, how big your house is, how many rooms your house is, whether you have a car. I mean, they were very systematic. They were a state. And they tax people like a state. And think how many times you're taxed living wherever you live in the Western world. And they were doing basically the same thing. And it's just logical for them to, choose antiquities as another source of revenue.
I want to come back to the brothers, Marwan and Radwan. Radwan talks about his seven-year-old has never gone to school, doesn't know the alphabet, doesn't know anything. I mean, which raises the question, how can there be anything like quote-unquote normal life for people living in the war zones?
Well, you can't. The uncertainty of living in a war zone is horrific. You don't know where you'll get food. You don't know whether you're going to be safe. You don't know whether Assad might drop a bomb on your head. That's why you have to leave. I mean, and this is part of this film, is to sensitize people to, you know, with that type of uncertainty, we're faced with the same choices that this family was faced with, then we would do the same thing and we would leave. And, you know, this family is, you know, very normal working class family. Like Marwan had a truck shop, and he repaired trucks, and Radwan had a cell phone shop and sold cell phones. I would hope that people would understand that their struggle could be anyone in America today, And that's why I think we should be looking at re-examining this sort of travel ban that's being proposed, and maybe considering open the door to, you know, the right type of Syrians and help them in their time of need.
What would be the right type of Syrians?
Well, the Syrians that, you know, normal working class Syrians that have been displaced by this war.
I am struck by the many people in the early part of the film who still speak with wistful memories of what it was like in the early days, thinking after Arab Spring, hey, maybe this is for us. And they look hopeful and they look bright-eyed still in talking about those times. And they might as well have been going out in January of this year to put on pink hats and march with the people in the United States. But they found something very different. And a lot of people got killed in the process. And let's get another clip from somebody who remembers that time.
When you see such suffering, there's no childhood. So many of my friends were killed. And this is the hardest thing, you know. Before, we wanted many things. We wanted to change. But now we just want peace, you know. For stop killing children, I mean. Stop killing innocent people.
Well, and in fact, there is a fair amount of video of children being dug out of bombed buildings and things like that. And it's impossible not to be moved. And that raises the question for you, Nick, on a personal level. How much of this did you and the crew look at, and how did you not get either enraged or numb?
Well, we were constantly enraged. But at some point, you have to channel your anger and try and create a coherent argument. And between Sebastian and I, it was always... It's a very fine line to walk between showing something that's brutal and brutalizing your audience. And we want to show how the brutal nature of war, but we're trying to sensitize people to a different issue. So you notice that we tend to, you may see some people being dug out of the rubble, but, you know, that's the reality of the war, and people need to understand that.
I guess I am struck more than anything by the changes over time, where you see streets that look like streets that could be in any fairly crowded city, and then as time goes on, you see those same streets with a lot of rubble in the streets and wires hanging down and clearly images of destruction, and then finally those very same streets added to that the pictures of people with heavy artillery mounted on pickup trucks. Shooting in these neighborhoods where people lived and worked, and in some cases still do.
Oh no, absolutely. It was a slippery slope, and once the regime started to attack the protesters with guns, then you started to see members of the army and air force defecting and fighting back, and then they armed themselves. Then you started to see neighborhood militias popping up. Then you started to see those neighborhood militias attacking police stations and arming themselves. Then you saw them trying to raise money to continue the fight. And then it just became a self-fulfilling prophecy or a vortex that just sucked in more and more people and drove people further and further towards more violence.
And one of the first people we meet who defected in the way you talked about is he was a colonel in the Syrian army, general. He's now in the Free Syrian Army, General Abdul Jabbar al-Okaidi.
Okaidi
from the Free Syrian Army. He had expertise in fighting and weapons and a desire for a democratic and secular state. Was there ever really a time when it looked like the FSA was gaining the upper hand?
No, absolutely. In Aleppo, there was another commander called Haji Mara. And Haji Mara was brought so many of the local militias together, and if it wasn't for Hezbollah in that early time stopping the advance of the Free Syrian Army, and then then Assad, assassinating Haji Mara with a rocket, then I think you may have seen a different future for Syria right now. What I always found perplexing is that there was, American support for a variety of levels. There was like train and equip, but they seemed to focus on the neighborhood militias and the less well-trained militias rather than the existing military class. And I'm not quite sure why that is to this day.
You mean they preferred the militias to the Free Syrian Army?
Yeah. So there was no ability to for the Free Syrian Army to coordinate itself, because all the militias were being armed in different ways. And then you started to see other outside influences from the Gulf states coming, and them they were financing different militias, and you started to see the rise of the Salafist militias, and then that exponentially grew to become the Islamic State when they invaded from Iraq.
Have you been able to square away in your own mind, Nick, I mean, all the different players involved here? Because it seems like it changes daily, if weekly, if not daily.
It does change a lot, but the major players stay the same, even if they change their names.
All right, we'll come back and talk more with Nick Quested about what's going on in Syria. He and Sebastian Younger are the co-directors of Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. It'll screen on the National Geographic Channel on Sunday, June 11th. It's definitely a gripping film. It is not an easy film to watch in places, but it is about the reality of what life is like for people who have remained in Syria while the civil war grinds on through 6.5 years now. You can join the conversation on The Exchange when we come back. Nick Quested and your phone calls and emails in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the longtime British filmmaker Nick Quested, who has teamed up with Sebastian Younger, the journalist, for several films since Restrepo. The latest one is called Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. It's been shown in a couple of big cities and comes to the National Geographic Channel this coming Sunday, June 11th. You can join our conversation with Nick Quested about the process of making this film. They did not go into Syria themselves. It was too dangerous, but found people who were willing to take cameras and record their own lives, which are people trying to live some lives of meaning in the midst of war zones. Really difficult things to do, but you can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about Syria and all the many different people involved in the process and what possible solutions might be. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the proliferation of militias, and there's a pretty good clip from the movie that lays this out, and I want Darnell to play that now.
FSA was a fantastic media label term, but there was no central authority, no one could command anyone, no one could have a one unity on a front line. I would go to a village, it has 5-6 militias. I would come a few months later, they have multiplied into 50-60. Because forming a militia became a way of getting money. The amount of money, the amount of ammunition, the amount of weapons pumped into that conflict totally destroyed the revolution and turned it into the dynamics of civil war.
So instead of being one large faction against the Assad regime, it became all these other factions fighting each other. Where was the money coming from, as you understand it, Nick?
Well, I think you can see from the news recently when Qatar has been exiled by its neighbors that the Qataris were instrumental in pumping billions of dollars into the war in Syria. And the Saudis, too. And everyone had their own slightly different agenda, and they were prepared to fight each other tooth and nail. And when you have such a diverse and confrontational opposition, even amongst themselves, that type of vacuum gives rise to even further extremism. And that was an open door for the Islamic State to walk in to Syria and colonize it, basically, from Iraq.
So the money coming from elsewhere in the region, I mean, did they benefit from the chaos, or were they trying to keep Assad in power, or were there...
Oh, no, they were trying to depose Assad. I mean, I think, there's many reasons. You can see the Russians got involved because the Qataris on the other side of this equation in terms of, like... The Russians have a monopoly on natural gas delivery to Europe. Mm-hmm. The Qataris, apart from wanting to help their Salafist brothers in Syria, they have an interest in a direct pipeline from Qatar to Europe. It would save them an enormous amount of money. They don't have to liquefy the gas, put it on boats, and sail it to Europe anymore. it would be, you know, and that's already an immensely wealthy country, especially per capita. So no, these militias started to. There was a proliferation of cell phones early in 2012, and these proliferation of cell phones were used to basically create marketing materials that they used to market to the Gulf states. So the most successful militias were the ones that used social media and, you know, the technology at the time to create marketing tools that could be used within the Gulf states, whether it be the actual governments themselves or through charities and NGOs that were based there.
So like grant writing via cell phone?
Yeah, basically. Wow. Military success documented by cell phone.
Wow. So were the fighters coming from within Syria? I mean, did some of the ISIS people come over from the Iraq side?
The Islamic State originally came, mutated. The Islamic State in Iraq mutated out of al-Qaeda in Iraq and was a response to the overwhelming Shia government and the suppression of the Sunni population in Iraq. Once they used Islam as a marketing tool to recruit. Once they had established a power base in Iraq, the former secret police, the former Iraqi army officers that were debathified by Bremer in CPA number 2, where he just decided to disenfranchise, you know, several hundred thousand, if not millions, of Iraqi Sunnis.
Bremer was the American head of the occupational force, yeah.
Yeah, it was his first major act, and as General Petraeus said, big mistake. Mm-hmm. Once they built their power base throughout the north of Iraq, they crossed the border and started to colonize Syria. There's actually a journalist that found the notebook from Haji Bakir that documents exactly how Christoph Reuters is his name, exactly how the plan was to unfold.
So obviously a lot, as you just mentioned, from the debathification of the army in Iraq, that's what gave a lot of the military expertise and strength to the Islamic State upon its rise. Now, did they find takers among army defectors in Syria, or did they end up on the other side? Did most of them go to the Free Syrian Army?
I think most of the defectors from the Syrian army went to the FSA, but it doesn't mean that once you're in the FSA, you had to join the strongest militia, because if you weren't in the strongest militia, you were vulnerable to be overrun by a militia that was stronger than you. And that's why this race to the most violent and the most aggressive became so fast and violent.
We have a couple of phone calls here. Let's go to Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Cuesta, the co-director of Hell on Earth.
Thank you for taking my call. My understanding, historically, the government of Assad, the father, they were extremely brutal. And in 82, where there was some uprising in Hama, where they basically demolished the whole place on the population. The second thing with regard to, I would like to see how you speak of ISIS as coming from Iraq, which is true. A lot of its leadership, they were in jails in Abu Ghraib and in Syria, and intentionally where they were released in order to create this terrorism as a way that Assad is suppressing terrorism or fighting terrorism. The second thing is that the nuclear deal with Iran, it seems Obama was promising the Syrians, but he never really came through. It seems Iran really called the shot in Syria with regard to the dealing with the United States. And also you could see Obama at the end, he always spoke of Plan B, and at the end, they said, we have really no plan B or anything.
Okay, let's get a response. Thanks for the call, Al. Appreciate that.
Okay, so there's several issues there. The first thing being, you mentioned the the ISIS leadership being in Abu Ghraib? Absolutely. It was safer for the ISIS leadership to be in Abu Ghraib or in Camp Buka, which is where Baghdadi was. They chose Baghdadi as a religious figurehead and pushed him straight out front, and Baghdadi was actually able to move and communicate amongst the various camps in Camp Buka. There was different levels of prisons throughout the larger jail there. But, you know, people say, well, the Islamic State were hiding in Anbar province. And no, it's not true. They were hiding in the safest place for those people was already having been incarcerated. And then you talk about there was three general amnesties throughout 2012, and they were absolutely designed to create a Salafist opposition to the Syrian Arab Republic. Many Salafists were released during that time. And they were released not just simply let out of, you know, Sednaya prison. They were released, and they were released in batches and held in regional centers in order for them to create their network. And in addition to that, the Syrian Arab Republic bombed their own Air Force secret police headquarters when there was no one in it and gave that footage to Jalani to use as a marketing tool to raise money for Jabhat al-Nusra in Qatar.
They bombed their own headquarters, vacant, and then gave the footage to somebody else to say, here, you can use this for bragging rights to raise money and troops.
Absolutely.
Wow. What about the other part of what Al was saying about Iran and its potential involvement?
Well, Iran's potential involvement and their support of Hezbollah is, a continued a legacy of the Eastern Bloc support for the Shia Crescent. So, there's always been a desire to link Lebanon, Syria, and Iran all the way through to create some type of coherent Shia...
Shia corridor, in a sense?
Yeah, Shia corridor.
Let's take another call. Here's Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Cuesta, the co-director of Hell on Earth.
Hi. Well, I have been interested in the fact that a lot of the reason for the uprising in Syria is due to drought and food shortages that have been linked to global warming. And I've also, so I'm wondering if you address that in your documentary. And I see this as kind of a canary of what's going to happen in other countries as food. Like right now, there's an estimated 20 million people that are dying of starvation in three countries in the Horn of Africa due to drought and lack of food. And I also just want to say, you know, the U.S. is not innocent in all this. We have been geopolitically maneuvering through the CIA, as John Perkins wrote about in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, basically putting developing countries in debt where they can't pay it off, and then they take the resources. And so I just wonder if you paint a total picture of what's going on and how, you know, the geopolitical maneuvering for fossil fuels has played a key part in all of this anger for the U.S. and other countries.
Thanks.
And I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, this film is exactly about how geopolitical decisions from the superpowers filter down through the concentric circles of influence to affect the people on the ground. So how do those political decisions from geopoliticians affect politicians that affect commanders that affect combatants that infect inhabitants? Affect, not infect. Sorry. And so that's exactly, we touch on that in many ways. Now, you mentioned the drought. We didn't directly address the drought, but we did address the corruption that was endemic to the Syrian Arab Republic. And that corruption is the root cause of many of the Salafist uprisings that you see around the world, whether it be in Nigeria or Sudan or in Somalia, and is definitely the root cause of the Arab Spring, or one of the root causes of the Arab Spring. And I would agree that these droughts and this global warming is going to exacerbate many countries and foment resistance.
Nick, we got about a minute left, and I want to just explore your thoughts on, because Obama is mentioned in the film and how the Free Syrian Army was hoping there would be a move after the red line statement, and there wasn't, which didn't give them the backing they'd hoped for. Many people defected pending the intervention of the United States, which didn't come. The United States did intervene under Trump with the cruise missiles to the air base. What do you think either of those decisions did ultimately?
Well, I think that, when you have to look at Obama's decision, and the people we interviewed felt that, it's not as simple as it appears. I mean, there was no intervention, but if you were to intervene, then how would you intervene? To whose benefit? And then what would happen? I mean, if they'd have intervened, would Assad have fallen, and would you have a Salafist state now? And is that something that the world wants to see? And then, what was the other part of the question?
About the Trump cruise missile bombing.
Yeah, I think the cruise missile attacks was impulsive and was playing to the president's base. They think that it's actually an effective thing to do. I think what is actually more effective is the arming of the Kurdish militias, the SDF, the PKK, the YPG, in their fight against the Islamic State in the western part of the country. I mean, the SDF were on the outskirts of Raqqa, and they will then probably move to take Deir ez-Zor. I think that is a much more sustained and effective way to deal with the menace of the Islamic State.
All right, much coming in the days to come, certainly. The moment in time captured in the movie Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS, coming to the National Geographic Channel on Sunday, June 11th. Nick Quested, co-director with Sebastian Younger. Nick's been our guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a pleasure.
Take it easy.